Good morning. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 on your FM dial. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and Celeste. And today is Monday. It is approximately 7:35 in the morning. For those of you who are just waking up, open up your eyes wide and you will see that it is raining. This is More Talk Radio and we are excited to have you as part of our listening audience this morning. I want to remind you that if you have announcements or concerns for the community, please share them with us. Drop us a short note, and we will gladly share the information with those in the KBOO listening audience. Let me remind you that joining us this morning will be David Sirota, who is the author of Hostile Takeover, its subtitle, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back. It should be an exciting interview. It's a book that certainly caught my attention, got me angry, got me upset, but ultimately and gave me some encouragement about things that we can and ought to do. So stay tuned to listen to David this morning in a few minutes and also to participate in our conversations. Shortly after our conversation, we'll open up our phone lines, and those numbers are 503-231-8187. Don't dial just yet. Wait a few minutes. We'll let you know when you can participate in the conversation. Let me remind those of you who are listening who have not called recently that we recently instituted a new device, I should say, which makes it easier, I think, for our engineer. But what happens when you call, you will probably be placed on hold for a while, but we advise you to turn down your radio because there's some sort of delay mechanism. So if you're listening on the phone and listening on the radio and if you're on the air, it creates all types of confusion as if you're in the Twilight Zone. So if you call, turn down your phone, hold, listen through your earpiece on your telephone, and when you hear Celeste in her lovely voice said, caller, you are on the air, that means you, and then you can address...
That means you're on the air.
You're on the air.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can address your concerns. Lots of stuff happening. Thursday, May 25th at 12 noon at Portland City Hall, Stand Up for Our Communities. Now, this is a call for united action, a call for house and justice that will take place on this Thursday at 12 noon at Portland City Hall, 1221 Southwest 4th Avenue. The Bush administration, the U.S. Congress, and HUD are gutting crucial housing programs for seniors, vets, people with disabilities, families with children. That's just about all of us. Having a stable, safe, and affordable place to call home gives people an opportunity to build better lives. The third annual Housing Justice Day rally will focus on the continued federal cutbacks to proven housing programs and what we can do here locally and across Oregon to open the doors for housing opportunity. Stand in unity against the federal cutbacks that are undermining housing stability for all of us, especially seniors, vets, people with disabilities, and families with children. Come to this rally this Thursday, 12 noon. Some of the Rally for Housing Justice sponsors include Affordable Housing Now, Community Alliance of Tenants, Washington County Housing Advocacy Groups, and others. For more information, you may contact Affordable Housing Now. You may go to contact them, call Michael Anderson at 503-335-9884, or you may email him at mike@cdnportland.org. That's mike@cdnportland.org. Again, a National Housing Justice Day rally for housing justice on this Thursday at 12 noon at Portland City Hall. And continuing with our announcements, Celeste, you want to add to?
Certainly. I've got one. And this event takes place this coming Tuesday, tomorrow, that is. The Circle is Round is a revealing, honest, and compelling glimpse into the lives of some of the 20,000 children in the state of Oregon who have an incarcerated parent. The documentary was created by a team of girls ages 8 through 15 that participate in the Girl Scouts Beyond Bars program. Together, they will tell their moving and powerful stories of loss, reunion, and hope. The Circle is Round is made possible by a grant from the Oregon Community Foundation, and the Girl Scouts Beyond Bars Advisory Board invites you to the movie premiere, which takes place, as I said, tomorrow, at the Northwest Natural Gas Building. That's at 220 Northwest 2nd. That's 220 Northwest 2nd. In the hospitality suite on the fourth floor. It takes place at 5:30 p.m. Tickets are $25 in advance, $30 at the event. Sounds like a lot, but remember, this helps support Girl Scouts Beyond Bars. Register by calling Evelyn at 503-598-6506. That's 503-598-6506.
And certainly we'll have these announcements at the front desk. I was just thinking as Celeste was reading that last announcements, and here I am fully awake, wanted to write down that phone number and not being able to find
a pen, a crayon, anything.
And so some of you who are just like turning over might also have difficulties. Therefore, I suggest give us a call at the front desk after 9 o'clock, and the person there will be happy to share with you the information we have shared this morning.
Yes.
At your convenience.
And then this Thursday coming is the last Thursday on Alberta Street. And if you sally forth, you go down there, you will find that there will be an opportunity to take part in the beginning of the Sabin CDC vision for Portland. It's a visioning process. And one of the things that will be taking place is not only an opportunity to discuss it at some community forums, but you'll have an opportunity to perhaps sign up and take place as one of the crew who will be out recording the thoughts and information of folks. And stay tuned, because they'll also have hotspots where you can have a video interview of your thoughts and your ideas about Portland's visioning process their project.
Is this the mayor's visioning?
That's their part. So they got a grant to do this, and they're doing a multimedia version of it.
Well, this is great that your city dollars are at work.
Hey, well, you know, here's the thing. We need a plan.
We need a plan.
We need a new plan.
And the mayor has been in office for how long?
This is Monday. I jettisoned anything about that.
Oh, okay.
I want to say 2 years.
Well, that's my point. And this visioning process is...
They've been working on it. You know, like any good project, you got to have some progress taken at incremental steps. In other words, there was the internal process, and now you got your external process. And part of the external process is various agencies and groups can apply for grants to go out and get the information from the populace as to how they want to see this fair city run.
I am so excited by this yet another process, visioning. Well, it's called visioning process this time.
I
spent most of the weekend reading David Sirota, Hostile Takeover, and I have been so saddened or
disappointed.
And I'm encouraged. You know, Mayor Potter just is the recipient of some of my ongoing anxiety or anger over the state of our world today. So
Well, he's on a lower level, though.
He's on a lower level. And as David Sirota mentioned in his book, you know, he also not only critiques but gives suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
One of his suggestions is be a big fish in a small pond, meaning that you can make a world of difference and probably, you know, in your local communities more so than in the national community. So begin locally, and then that transformation takes place. So just one of his suggestions, and this is a good place to start in terms of how we can change things in our community. And, you know, last week was the elections in our area. Something that David talks about is public financing of campaigns, and we saw here locally the voters' own election was the first cycle. You had it was such a classic case, I think, in terms of one of the races among those who one was financed by money of big corporations or people who did not want the city to investigate the possibility.
You know, it's after the race. You can say that now.
It's after the race?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Enron was financing Jenny Burdick's campaign against Eric Sten because...
Well, basically, they just didn't want Eric in.
They didn't want Eric in because...
They wanted somebody who was going to be more sympathetic to their needs.
Who carried their money bags.
Mm-hmm.
And in our first election... they spend a lot of money. They, you know, were not successful.
Well, you know, it seems to be a small turning of the tide here. Not only do you have to be concerned with the fact that some candidates who have big money and who are spending very large are still not winning, the tide has possibly shifted so that people might really be looking behind the curtain to find out where's that money coming from? Who are you beholden to and actually responding to it? But I think maybe I'm going to agree with our guest that it has to be more evident, or it seems to be more evident, rather, on the smaller levels, on the lower levels.
Well, let us welcome David Sirota, who is the author of Hostile Takeover, recently published, and he is just a little bit, he's a journalist, who's graduated from Northwestern University, has served also in government as on the staff of Vermont Representative Bernie Sanders. And one of the things I've read, I think on one of those websites, is Mr. Sirota continues to be a thorn in the side of not only those in the Republican parties, but also the Democratic Party. We're so glad to have you with us this morning. Thank you for being here. Good morning.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning.
Good morning to you.
So there are so many questions, and I'm trying to figure out a way to kind of order these so I don't jump too far ahead. But to say that the premise behind the book was to expose it was the corruption was possibly not what I saw. What I saw was something that kind of shook me a little bit more than that, and that's the fact that we've got politicians, we've got big money, we've got corporations who are spending money not so much on the politicians' means of keeping them in power, but more so they're spending money to change the way we listen to rhetoric, to change the way the rhetoric comes across, to undermine our confidence in the fact that there is a process that will unveil wrongdoing and let us know what's going on and to keep us in the know. And I think that was what was more frightening to me, was the fact that big power, big money, and politicians are operating just to keep us from knowing anything, to skew it so we can't know what they're doing, or we're not believed when we do say that this is not so.
Well, you're exactly right, and that is the fundamental assertion I make in the book, that corruption is the worst form of corruption is what's legal. The worst form of corruption is not the vote buying and the bribery and all the scandals we hear about, but the fact that the political debate coming out of our political establishment is one that is designed to marginalize any policies that the public might support that would challenge big money interests and the profit motive. So, for instance, we see this on energy most pronounced. Up until very recently, the debate over our energy crisis has been a debate between over which tax breaks to give to which oil companies, rather than a debate over how to crack down on oil industry profiteering. So policies like a windfall profits tax, a federal price gouging law, better Federal Trade Commission enforcement of antitrust laws, those public policies, which are strongly supported, as polls show, by the vast majority of Americans, those are not part of the political debate. And that leads us to believe, or the desire of those politicians who seek to marginalize those policies, is to make the public feel like what it wants is unimportant and not in the mainstream, even though, again, as public opinion polls show, it is. And so if we're looking for a reason as to why our government doesn't solve problems anymore, it's because you can't solve problems as a government if you're unwilling to confront the big money interests who are often at the center of these problems.
Well, speaking of the big money interests who remains at the centers of this problem, I think it remains the centers of the problem because of what I detected in your book as a fundamental shift maybe in the American psyche, a move from seeking the common good to the supreme ideal seemed to be wealth creation for individuals. And so even to have the discussion about the common good becomes somewhat truncated in national discussions.
I think you're right. I think though that again that what I believe is really the problem is that there is a disconnect, a deliberate disconnect, between the narrative about our public policies and our government that we hear from the establishment, and the narrative and the policies that ordinary citizens support. That I think that when you look at extensive public opinion data, this country is far more supportive of policies that pursue the common good than our government is willing to even discuss. And that's because the interests that finance the political campaigns of our representatives in government, they are the ones who are uninterested in a society that protects the common good. They are the ones who are doing quite well under a system of survival of the fittest, every man for themselves. They are the ones, for instance, in the energy sector. ExxonMobil is the one that's making $8 billion every quarter, the most of any corporation in history. At the same time, they are bleeding consumers dry with $3 gas. When one in five health people don't have health insurance in this country, and tens of millions or more can't afford their health insurance premiums, somebody is profiting off that. We saw a couple weeks ago the CEO of United Health, the health insurance company, he's made $1.6 billion, him personally, in the last couple of years. So what we see, again, is that there is a very, very tightly knit consensus that is trying to protect the status quo, because that status quo is serving very, very powerful, very, very wealthy interests.
And that that cabal, which is serving the wealthy interests, is a equal opportunity in terms of both Democrats and Republicans bow down before this altar. If, for example, I thought that the Democrats would offer an alternative and look at, thinking of personal bankruptcy, I might say, well, the Democrats might have a solution. And if I went to the senator from Indiana, I might get similar remarks that I would think I would hear from a Republican. I'm speaking of Senator Bayh.
Right. Senator Bayh was the one on the bankruptcy, when they were debating the bankruptcy bill, which guts consumer bankruptcy protections. He's the one, I don't have the quote in front of me, but he essentially said that the bill was designed to crack down on irresponsible people. And that the problem of personal debt in this country, and personal debt is at its all-time high, and as are personal bankruptcies. The myth that most people who go bankrupt because they're irresponsible. So that was parroted by both Republicans and Democrats like Senator Evan Bayh. Meanwhile, statistics clearly show, the facts clearly show, and they've been reported over and over and over again by researchers, that most people, three-quarters of bankruptcies are due to either a death in the family or a major health care crisis in a family. Not exactly the irresponsible deadbeats that we're led to believe that bill targeted. In fact, if you want to talk about what that bill did for people who were ripping off the system, we should understand that that bill simultaneously eliminated bankruptcy protections for ordinary citizens while expanding bankruptcy protections for the very wealthy. And here's what I mean. The same bill that guts consumer bankruptcy protections actually includes a provision to preserve and strengthen bankruptcy protections for people who have more than $2 million of business debts. So let's understand what that means. That means that if you are forced to go into massive personal debt on your credit card because somebody in your family got sick and you had to pay huge health care premiums and you're tens of thousands of dollars in debt, you don't get serious bankruptcy protections. But if you're Ken Lay, Enron's Ken Lay, and you've ripped off tens of millions of dollars from shareholders and employees, and you owe them tens of millions of dollars in debts, you get more extensive bankruptcy protections. You get better protections than the ordinary citizen. That was all in the same bill.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7. In the city, 91.9. In the Columbia River Gorge, 100.7. In the Willamette Valley. On the web, we are KBOO.FM. This is More Talk Radio with Cecil and myself, Celeste, and we're speaking with David Sirota, who is the author of Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government, and How We Can Take It Back. And don't forget, if you enjoy the conversation this morning, tomorrow, Tuesday, May 23rd, at Powell's Books on Burnside, which is out in the northwest part of town, you'll have an opportunity to see and hear David, and that'll be at 7:30, again, Tuesday, at Powell's Books on Burnside. So we've written this book, or we have found that there's a need for you to write this book. And in the book, you kind of laid out why we should read the book, how we can use the book, and what's going to happen if we really take this seriously. Not to belabor the obvious, but just to kind of give people an idea that this is a systematic squeezing of the American pocketbook as well as the American credibility. What is this book for? Is it for just the Republican or the Democrat, as Cecil mentioned, or is it for anyone who feels that, regardless of party, enough is enough and we need to take our party and our process back?
No, you're right. This book is really not for political insiders, lobbyists, politicians, operatives. It's not only for Republicans or only for Democrats or only for liberals or only for conservatives. This book is for everybody who really is interested in their democracy, who is interested in seeing a government that does a far better job of protecting ordinary citizens' interests rather than exclusively protecting the interests of those with huge amounts of money. And I wrote it in a way so that it's not really super, super complex. It's not really super wonky. It's really written to show the ordinary citizen who's not, you know, following politics on a super moment-to-moment, hour-to-hour basis, to walk through exactly how our government is now essentially, as I say, a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America, and what the ramifications of that hostile takeover are on the average citizen. Because I think that polls show that people really understand that there's a serious problem with our government now. But I think that folks don't exactly know how that problem plays out on an issue-by-issue basis and how that problem affects ordinary citizens' daily life. This is what this book is for. And then, of course, the final chapter is once we realize where all the problems are, how we go about reclaiming our democracy.
Reclaiming our democracy is a long task, and I was wondering perhaps you can say something about the evolution of this takeover. I think from your book I get a sense that beginning particularly in the Reagan era, that there was a shift in terms of governmental philosophy about the role of the relationship between government and business, but perhaps you can shed more light on this hostile takeover. How did
it
occur?
I think that you're right that over the course of the last 25 years, conservatives have used their ideological movement as a way to justify more and more policies that serve only corporate interest. This is the sort of trickle down economic theory that if you make sure that the wealthy and that big corporations are making huge amounts of money, that will automatically mean that those resources will flow down to ordinary citizens. We know, of course, that that's not true. I think but people have asked me, well, money always plays a role in politics. So how what's so different about now than eras past? Well, look, I think that there's always been one big business party in this country, and there's always going to be a big business party in this country, and money is always going to play a role in politics. But I think that over the last 25 years, we've seen that we now have about 1.25 or 1.33 big business parties, that a chunk of the Democratic Party has been co-opted, and that has allowed the entire political process to shift radically towards big money's agenda. I mean, the crowning achievement, of course, I think, was getting a Democratic president, Bill Clinton, to spearhead the passage of the North American Free Trade Agreement, a deal that systematically undermined workers' wages, jobs, health care and pension benefits in this country, a pact that has destroyed the Mexican economy to the point where 20 million more Mexicans now live in poverty since NAFTA was passed, and that has obviously a lot to do with pressure for illegal immigration at our border. Mm-hmm. This was spearheaded by a Democratic president with enough Democratic support joining full Republican support for the passage of this bill. So that should tell you everything you need to know about exactly the kind of partisan breakdown we have here when it comes to the hostile takeover and to fighting the hostile takeover.
So given that, when you say in terms of big money, it being 1.33 party, so given that, what do we have to expect from the rest of the party that is trying to make the change or might be yet uncorrupted? Is there any movement or action on their part to keep us aware of what's going on or to combat this? Or are they slowly but surely being wooed by money because money, after all, is going to be contributed to their various campaign war chests?
No, I think that there's a lot of reason to be optimistic. That I think that there are good people in a bad system who are fighting the takeover and who are making progress. Some of those people are detailed in my book. There are people in your community and in communities throughout the country who are fighting this takeover. I mean, I know that there was the recent municipal election in Portland where the public financing system and the publicly financed candidate was able to beat back a very serious challenge from a more corporate funded candidate. So I think there are reasons to feel inspired. I think that there is also communications and ideological infrastructure being built that is designed to support good people who want to stand up for ordinary citizens. I mean, you know, I could name a bunch of org. You know, there's Move On. I'm co-chair of the new Progressive States Network, which is designed to support good state legislators who are standing up for ordinary citizens. So I think this is a long battle, but I think there's very, very much reason to feel optimistic and to realize that just because somebody's in the system doesn't mean they're part of the problem, and that those people in the system who are fighting the takeover, I think, are feeling more and more emboldened than ever that there is a real movement in this country to fight back.
One of the things that separate you from many authors that we interview is that you have also worked inside Congress, and so you know the pressure that people face. I'm thinking that most people, regardless of ideological slant, approach politics or enter politics with this sense of a noble calling to do something good for their community.
What they can do for their country, right.
Having worked within Congress, what happens when people enter into the District of Columbia?
Well, I think that they enter into a culture that prioritizes somebody's ability to raise corporate cash, that the culture there essentially says that it is unacceptable or looked down upon to really take seriously representing ordinary citizens. And I think that has, over the years, a corrosive effect on even some of the best people who start out with good ideals. Now, that's not to say that it smacks down everybody, but we have a system that you know, selects for people who are good at pretending that they support ordinary citizens, but who in reality are trying to perpetuate the status quo. And I think that it takes only the truly truly stubborn are able to exist in that system and keep their integrity. And again, there are good examples of that. The issue is that we're not really going to have a government that represents us unless we actually change the system, unless we actually make it easier for the unextraordinary politician to represent their citizens. Right now, we essentially have a system where you have to be extraordinary to fight back within this system in Washington. What we need to get to is a point where even the average, the typical politician has an incentive to fight back.
You're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland, and we're speaking with David Sirota. We'd love for you to join in the conversation. The phone number is 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. And don't forget that when you do call in, there is a delay, so that will require you to turn your radio down very low and to listen. And when you hear the magic words, you are on the air. That means come forth, sally forth. In your book, you've got it broken down into sections here to explain how some of the key parts of our lives have been corrupted, taken over, co-opted, and that ranges from taxes and jobs to, as we mentioned earlier, you and Cecil talking about debt, to unions, energy, actually all the way down to legal rights. Just to pick on a couple of those, one of the things, of course, that has been a big issue because we've got so many senior citizens is the health care and prescription drugs. So after we take this call, I'd like to just talk a little bit about that and how it's been co-opted, and then hit on some of the other key items from your book. And we do have some callers online, so let's go to them. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. How about yourself?
Well, I'm doing fine. I thought I'd never say this on KBOO, but you know, as a staunch Republican, I think that both sides of the aisle in our government are corrupted.
And you've got company right here.
What's that?
I said, you have company right here. That's just what our guest believes, too.
And as we just heard, you know, about what Bill Clinton did with NAFTA and how the Republicans, and I support Bush, and I'm a Republican, and I'm a businessman, but you know what? The greed and the corruption in Washington has gotten to such extremes. I mean, we hear things like, you know, I'm going to Washington, elect me because I want to serve the American people. I want to make a difference. You know, we got all this BS, rhetoric that we hear from both sides of the aisle, and they probably mean well, but when they get there, I think the corruption and the money just takes over, and they lose all insight of what they really were elected to do there.
I couldn't agree more. I think that we have to identify exactly why, because I don't want people to think that that you have to be evil to run for office, or that government is inherently evil. We have to understand that we have a system that selects for a certain kind of person, that advances certain kinds of people.
Engineer, can you make that critical adjustment there? Pot that one down. Thank you. And I think that's one of the critical things, because when you say that the system selects for specific personalities or people, or those who have targeted and very defined goals, can you clarify that? Because a lot of us are getting so disheartened, we think, what's the point of even selecting the good candidates if once they're good, they're going to go bad?
Well, I think, again, if you have a system that is privately financed, you have a system that forces people who want to run for office to be specialists in shaking down big money interests in order to get the resources to run their campaigns. And so these people have every incentive not to ever even consider biting the hand that feeds them.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, even a good person has to think, well, if I take a position that actually represents my constituents but might put me at odds with an industry that is making huge amounts of cash off of profiteering, and we could go through whichever industry we want to talk about, as I detail in my book, they have to think, you know, if I do that, I might lose the necessary campaign resources to run for re-election. And so that is not necessarily a commentary on the person. It's more of a commentary on the system. The system is saying, essentially, that in order to succeed, you must bow down to the people who fund this system. And so until we really give candidates all over the country a way to run for office where they don't have to be in this pay-to-play quid pro quo situation of money in, favors out, then we're never really going to get the kind of systemic change that we need.
And the caller, we've lost him, but he basically said that, you know, he's a staunch Republican who has supported it. Now, given his testimony, I guess what does even the party that some of us is who oppose, what do that we have to look forward to in terms of real change with regard to campaign finance reform being supported? Is this always going to be a grassroots thing? Is it something that we can never expect coming out of the Republican Party, or is this something that will have such a sweeping effect? We'll see it on both sides of the aisle, and of course, buoyed by the independent parties.
Well, I think that we have to realize that, first of all, this is not a liberal or conservative or Republican or Democrat idea. That is public financing. I think that we've seen it in blue states and red states and municipalities. You know, it was passed in Connecticut, which is a blue state. It was passed in long time ago in Arizona, which is a very, very conservative state. Obviously, Portland has a version of public financing. So I think there's hope that this can happen. I think that it won't happen, and it hasn't happened in the places that it has, without pressure and grassroots organizing at the local level to move the political powers that be towards this. That one of the prescriptions in my book, and I have a whole chapter on how we take our government back, mm-hmm. is for us to start focusing far more locally, that we can actually influence local politics in a profound way, that the hostile takeover is far less pronounced as you go down the political food chain. You put, you know, 50 people in a room with a state legislator, and you tell that state legislator, we want you to vote this way on this bill, or we're going to vote you out of office. I'm not saying that person's automatically going to change, but they're certainly listening, and they're certainly listening a lot more than folks higher on the political food chain. And those folks often have jurisdiction over areas that can really make a profound change in our political system and in our lives.
You're listening to David Sirota, author of Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back. David will be at Powell's tomorrow, Tuesday, May 23rd at 7:30. That's Powell's on Burnside. Our number is 503-231-8187. And caller, you are on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Celeste. First of all, let me tell you up front that I'm one of the people who's benefiting hugely from burgeoning oil profits. Because I own a whole bunch of oil company shares. And secondly, I'm also a fairly avid environmentalist. So I find myself in an interesting position on this issue. But I just want to make a comment on Mr. Sirota's observation that there's more support for common cause of, in the U.S. population than people are given credit for. That may well be true, but I find an interesting problem here in the U.S. when it comes to gasoline prices, for instance. My take would be, as an environmentalist, would be to either tax the hell out of it or make it very expensive in one fashion or another, because petroleum is a fairly limited resource and going to be put to much better use than driving internal combustion engines. So as far as I'm concerned, from an environmental perspective, the higher the cost of gasoline, the better. And yet people down here are complaining about it, even though, for instance, where I live in Canada, the equivalent price is $4.40 U.S. a gallon, and we make the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I guess maybe Mr. Sirota is correct, but it seems to me there could be a lot more awareness on the part of the U.S. public as to what's good for people in general and the environment in the long run.
Well, I don't disagree with the idea that higher gas prices could drive down demand. My issue is why do we only focus on mm-hmm. the prescriptions that further squeeze the middle class?
Mm-hmm.
That high gas prices drive down demand, but at a regressive cost, that hits people lower on the income scale far harder, and that there are prescriptions, public policy prescriptions, to deal with this issue in a way that doesn't necessarily do that. So for instance, we haven't really had a serious debate in this country about serious fuel efficiency standards.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We haven't had a serious debate in this country about cracking down on oil industry price gouging, which is a very, very, very real situation. And I'm happy to go into detail about that. My book goes into serious detail about that. We haven't had a serious discussion in this country about better enforcing our antitrust laws at the Federal Trade Commission when it comes to the oil industry. In fact, what we have now is a Federal Trade Commission headed by a former Chevron Texaco lawyer. So I don't think the caller is wrong on what he's saying and the ramifications of what he's saying. What I'm saying is that the real problem is that we have a government that's unwilling to consider any policies that might make the solutions to our problems fall more equally on big money interests as they do on individual working citizens.
Well, I guess my only response is that a pragmatist, I think, is probably a lot, you'll much more effectively address the consumption end of it than you will the big money aspect of it, because big money is going to dodge around it just like they traditionally have. So, you know, I'd rather change consumer behavior. I'd rather concentrate on changing consumer behavior than going after something that may or may not work. You know, people are
right,
just driving too much.
But you need to think about. I mean, let me just give you an example. I'm here in Montana. Gas prices at $3 or $3.50 or $4 or whatever height you want to put them at. This is the state with the lowest wages in the country. This is a rural state. This is a working class state. Now, you might drive down demand for gas when you raise those prices, but you are going to crush the economy here. Crush it, and you will not crush the corporate executives or the fat cats or the very wealthy. You will be crushing the economy on the back of ordinary citizens, farmers, people who have to, by virtue of the fact that this is a rural state, who have to drive to work, and obviously, you know, there are no cars, or there are very few cars that are available with serious fuel efficiency standards. So what I'm saying is, I don't disagree with the outcome. What I'm saying is that there is a far greater social cost to most Americans and most citizens by pursuing that as the major solution rather than other things as the major solution.
Thank you, caller.
Thank you.
One thing that the caller suggested, and perhaps you could address it before we take our next caller, Mr. Sirota, is the sense that big money is always going to be there and a corrupting influence. Therefore, we have to live with it.
And therefore, we have to take the hit. Or as you said in the book, we have to suck it up.
Right, and I think that that's one of the things that I think that cynicism breeds, is that, you know, the last caller sort of said that. He sort of said, well, I'm more into being a pragmatist, and, you know, these moneyed interests are going to control the debate, so I'd rather go for something that doesn't try to ideally fix the system. I'm more of an optimist. You know, I look back at history, and I see an American history where money has always played a role, but our citizens have managed to get reforms that have bettered our society. I think that that pessimism and cynicism is the greatest asset to the big money interests who control our politics. That right now is a time of great opportunity, that the public is really outraged, and the issue is, are we going to have people to take that outrage and channel it by inspiring folks and channel it into a positive movement to take our government back? I think that's very possible. I see the outlines of that movement every day, and I think that people shouldn't be depressed. We should simply realize that this is a far longer fight than one election. That if we look at it only in terms of one or two elections, it's going to be depressing. If we look at the long view over a course of 10, 15, or 20 years, I think we will see that we are really making progress right now.
Well, speaking of looking at the long view, and we are coming up to an election cycle, 2006, you've written recently about the Democratic prospects in 2006 in a recent article in terms of you titled it the Seinfeld strategy, which I think you critique Democrats' philosophy. And speaking of the energy, we saw this in the last election cycle, a lot of grassroots activism, a lot of money and activism going to Democratic causes, and we ended up with John Kerry as the Democratic nominee, and, you know, groups like the Democratic Leadership Council continue to be in power. What do you see are the possibility for real substantive changes in 2006? And are there candidates or things people should be working for in the congressional election as they look to 2008?
Well, I just would encourage people to have a more values and conviction-driven political activism than a candidate-driven political activism. Mm-hmm. And by that I mean that our movement, the movement to take back our government, needs to be independent of individual candidates. Look, John Kerry was not the perfect candidate, obviously. I had a lot of problems with John Kerry. But what I had a bigger problem with was the fact that our movement seemed to be only focused on who the nominee was and whether that nominee in that election was going to win, rather than on a longer-term effort to build up a movement based on conviction and ideology that would transcend one or two elections. So in a practical way, what I really mean is when people get involved in politics, they should be getting involved with candidates based on that candidate's stand on issues. They should be getting involved in ballot initiatives based on what that initiative will do. I think that our politics is too dominated by cults of personality. And I think that I should also say that I think that that's a particularly acute problem for progressives rather than conservatives. Mm-hmm. Conservatives have built a movement based on conviction and ideology. Now, whether you agree with that conviction or ideology is a separate thing. But everybody from dog catcher to president of the United States runs essentially on an ideological platform, mm-hmm. on the Republican side. On the Democratic and progressive side, we're usually talking about recruiting the perfect candidate, mm-hmm. the perfect personality with charisma, as opposed to having a movement that produces candidates of similar ilk up and down the ticket. That's where I think we need to really focus.
Can I ask a question from a different perspective here? This is kind of the everyday human perspective of not expecting perfection all the time. And I coach it in terms of the 80-20 rule. You know, none of us are going to get 100% of what we want out of any given situation or candidate. And given the fact that we can support their stance, maybe 80% of their stance on the topics and on the points that matter, should we even go for that perfect one? And is that part of what I think maybe is hampering our ability to support the good people that are coming along, because we're looking for that perfect person that's got the entire package of what we perceive to be charisma, power, et cetera, et cetera?
Well, I would agree with you, except I think that in many cases we're not even dealing with close to perfect. We're
mm-hmm.
dealing with
we're dealing with 70-30 environment.
We're dealing in a 40-60 environment.
I was thinking 70 against.
I also think that in many cases our orthodoxies are misdefined.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that on the progressive and democratic side I'll just speak about the Democratic Party. That the Democratic Party's major orthodoxies, that is things that it defines itself in perfect terms on, if you will,
mm-hmm.
in orthodoxy,
right.
Are issues that are not necessarily the ones confronting ordinary citizens on a day-to-day basis. Now, I want to say before I go into this that it's not that I don't think these issues are important. I certainly think they're important. But issues like gay marriage and choice, these are very important issues. But I'm concerned that the Democratic Party doesn't have equally as strong orthodoxies on issues like wages, on issues like free trade, on issues like health care, on issues like job security and pension security. So what I'm saying is I'm not saying that we should downplay orthodoxies on civil rights, civil liberties, and choice in the Democratic Party. What I'm saying is we need to ask ourselves, why are those the major orthodoxies, and we don't have similarly strong orthodoxies on the issues that actually cut across regions, that cut across cultural differences, that actually affect everybody, in their daily economic life. And I think that we have to strive for a politics that does have those orthodoxies.
Well, what are those orthodoxies that the Dems should initiate a value?
Well, I mean, look, this is my perspective, so
mm-hmm.
I'll give
mm-hmm.
you my,
yeah.
But I mean, everybody, I mean, my basic perspective is, you know, I think that the Democratic Party has not strongly supported improving people's wages. Mm-hmm. I think that the party, which has helped, been complicit in trade deals that overtly undermine Americans' wages, is proof that the party that does not have an orthodoxy on improving the economic lives of ordinary working people. I think that, you know, as I said recently, I said there's a problem when somebody who is a champion of NAFTA or the China trade deal, which has sold out America, can stand up at the Democratic Party's national convention and not be considered a controversial speaker. That should tell you everything you need to know about where the party's orthodoxies are. Yet, if somebody stands up and is pro-life, that's considered super controversial. Now, let me just say this. I'm pro-choice. I'm strongly pro-choice. But the problem is the dichotomy. Why is it when somebody who's pro-life and speaks at the Democratic National Convention, why are they considered controversial, but somebody who has voted time and time and time and time again to sell out ordinary Americans, why is that not considered controversial?
Well, you raise several points, and I'm thinking now in terms of Democrats and orthodoxies. I'm thinking of a race in Pennsylvania. Is it the senator from the Republican senator Sanctorum?
Mm-hmm.
Is he running against Casey?
He is.
And Casey's a pro-life Democrat, is he not?
That's correct.
Is he getting any flack because of that? Are you aware?
Oh, he absolutely has. He's gotten a number. I mean, there was I don't blame them. Some of the pro-choice groups have threatened to run against him, and I actually think that that's completely fine. I mean, pro-choice groups are there to advocate on that issue. That's completely fine. The issue is that there's been a bunch of chatter among sort of Democratic Party folks that it's either not acceptable or very controversial that Casey is pro-life.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think, you know, being somebody who is pro-choice, and I'm originally from Pennsylvania, you know, I would like Bob Casey to be pro-choice, but he's not. That said, I've heard some people say, well, you know, what's the difference? What's the difference between him and Santorum? Because, mm-hmm. you know, Santorum's ardently pro-life, too. Well, my answer is, Rick Santorum has voted 18 times against raising the minimum wage. Rick Santorum has voted for every trade deal that's come across his plate that has sold out American workers. Bob Casey has taken strong positions on these economic, core kitchen table economic issues. So there's a huge difference. And that's really what I'm trying to say, is that the Democratic Party, if it wants to be successful over the long haul, it has to show the public that it has its own orthodoxies on issues that are other than the ones that divide this country culturally. Whether you are pro-life or pro-choice, pro-gay marriage or anti-gay marriage, for example, everybody can acknowledge that those are issues that are divisive issues, that people in different parts of the country feel very strongly in different ways about those issues. I would argue that it is a far more unifying issue, a far more culturally cross-cutting issue, to advocate for far higher wages, to push a universal single-payer health care system that ensures everybody gets the health care they need. And so I would like to see a Democratic Party that has equally strong orthodoxies on the issues that unite us, rather than only on the issues that divide us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 in the metropolitan area. It's 8:34. Coming up at 9 o'clock is the Old Mole Variety Hour. And if you'd love to join in the conversation now, the phone number is 503-231-8187. This is a great chance to call. Don't forget to turn your radio down when you do come online. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, you know, I have a problem with progressives, because it seems like we're stuck in the rhetoric mode. And understanding this problem here, to me, the present system operates in large part on the same principles that chattel slavery operated back in the South. And except today, we're economic slaves. And when you talk about dealing with the system of slavery, to me, there's only one solution. You talk about abolishing that, not working within it. Because this system, capitalism, in order for it to function, that means it has to get over on somebody. And so in order for this system to work, it requires full participation. So what we should be talking about is not participating in this system. And for me, there's only one solution, that we should be encouraging everybody to go on a full strike and just quit working. And if you quit working, the rich people, they can't tolerate that very much. They're going to come around and they're going to try to change things, because they can't, you know, the slave master is nothing without his slaves.
Well, I agree, and I agree in this way. The caller raises an important point about work as a commodity, about the work that we do as citizens being used as an economic tool for social change, and I think it speaks to the need for folks to value and understand the requirement for an expanded labor movement, that the labor movement in this country has been responsible for major reforms that we now take for granted. I mean, it's just one example. When you have a weekend or a 40-hour work week, you should thank the labor movement, because it was the labor movement that did just as the caller said, used its work as an economic weapon to force positive social change. So I think that folks in their workplace, one of the front lines in the war against the hostile takeover, the fight to take our government back, is in everybody's workplace. People should be unionizing their workplace. This is one of the most basic steps towards fighting for our rights that we can take. And I think that, you know, obviously there's a lot of hostility to unions. We saw a couple of months ago the transit strikers in New York. People who run the transit system there went on strike, and there was a ton of hostility. The government of the city there tried to throw the union leader in jail for calling a strike after the city tried to slash workers' pensions. But I think that we ended up seeing that in New York they were successful, and nationally they've been successful in all sorts of ways. So the caller touches on a very, very important issue.
You're listening to KBOO. This is More Talk Radio, and good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Good.
Great discussion and great guest. I guess that one of the good things to remember when we are facing disillusionment, as Cecil said at the outset of the program, is that there's plenty of work to be done. And we each have our own point of view and our own capabilities, but there's something for everybody to get involved with. And one of the topics that I'd like to bring up is, you spoke earlier, Mr. Sirota, about being active at the state level, and I wanted to bring up the topic of political precinct delegates. That seems to me to be a golden opportunity for people to get involved. For example, in the last election, when I had the insert in my ballot to vote for precinct delegates, I didn't recognize any names. I had not been contacted or solicited by any of the people who were running. I looked at the other precinct slots, and there were many precincts where nobody was running, but it said vote for eight. I think this is a golden opportunity for people to get involved at a very much a neighborhood level and attempt to be active in their own party from the grassroots level. What do you think?
Well, I think you're right. I think that there are scores of offices, there are scores of opportunities to be involved in a real way. I think that what you've identified is just one example of how many open opportunities there are to really get involved. You know, on those races that you mentioned, you know, people should be considering running for those offices. You know, these offices may seem small, but they wield some form of power. and that ultimately, if we're going to accept the fact that the hostile takeover of our government has taken 30 or 35 years to accomplish, that if we take the long view, we have to realize that folks on the lower level of politics right now are tomorrow's congressmen, senators, governors, and presidents. Mm-hmm. And so that if we get to them now and show them that they can be rewarded with a politics that stands up for ordinary people, then we can start developing the leaders that we need for tomorrow, that will be really influential tomorrow.
May I ask a follow-up question?
Please.
I wonder if you would agree with me that many of us have a problem, citizens have a problem of alienation, and also the problem of our modern society with instant gratification. And I'm glad that you pointed out that these problems that we're facing today did not occur instantaneously or overnight, and therefore we need to be realistic and not expect an instant turnaround.
Yes, that you're absolutely right. I couldn't have said it better myself. That this takes real patience. That we have to look at the long view. We have to say, not how did we do only in this upcoming election, but how are we doing in the last 10 years? How are we doing in the next 10 years? And you're right. I mean, that to do that takes patience. It takes a conscious effort to get out of the instant gratification culture. But I'm confident that more and more people are seeing this. I'm confident that the need for systemic change and what it really takes to create systemic change is getting into the public awareness, and maybe that's a byproduct of election losses, that it just forces people to take the long view. But I'm confident that people are starting to understand the stiff odds and the scope of the battle that we face.
Thank you for doing your part by writing this book.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We're speaking this morning with David Sirota, who is the author of Hostile Takeover, How Big Money and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Can Take It Back. One thing I'm encouraged by this book, I mentioned it made me angry and frustrated, but I'm also encouraged by you offer some practical solutions, and that we, as the last caller stated, there are things that people can do. We have another caller, so caller, you are on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning. Is the point I would like to make is about is the nature of the two parties. Is that the Democrats have always been all of these kind of other people with what they have wanted on smaller agendas, where is it the Republicans have always been about the moneyed folks. And as Goldwater points out, this is that this tends to be a conservative country. When American politics was basically fought out over economics in the later half of the 20th century, starting in the 1930s, is that the Democrats did very well. But is the Republicans in the late 1950s, and it was the Nixon who originally, he started to hire advertising people, who figured out what kinds of issues they could use to get people all excited. And, you know, I support gay rights, but is the problem is you shouldn't be voting for the presidents by whether they support marriage or not. It should be fought on economics, because that's what the government really does. And that's really the biggest problem, is that the Republicans have been able to keep the agenda on these little niche issues that can get a lot of people very excited. And so they don't vote for their real economic interest. And is Republicans have been very brilliant. There's always been a certain amount of quote and unquote conservative Democrats and who tend to vote like the Republicans. So, you know, there's never been, you know, that's a great myth about the liberal media. It's actually a very conservative media, always has been, because who's always owned the media?
So you're talking about economic conservatism, right? Not social conservatism, or both?
Well, I'm saying that it's the economics which is the government is usually really concerned with, and that's what politics, when it's fought out on that basis. And when you get, in the old days, a lot of these other issues were considered to be the individual point of view of the legislature.
Let me respond to that by saying
on economics, because that's really what the government has some control over.
Let me just respond, caller, let him respond
because we're getting short of time.
Let me respond to what the caller is saying. What he's saying is, and I agree with him, that the issues of economics have been depoliticized, when in fact they should be the most politicized.
Mm-hmm.
That they should be at the center of our political debate, when in many cases they are considered outside of political debate. And I think that that is not an accident. That's deliberate. That the sort of consensus we see on all sorts of economic issues from the political establishment, trade is a good one, is an example of how it's not an accident. How depoliticizing, for instance, the issue of free trade and making it an orthodoxy or something that's assumed as a law of nature serves big money interests. Now, I don't blame people, ordinary people in many cases, for voting on social issues, mm-hmm. often against their own economic interests, because I think people in many cases rightly perceive that both parties have sold them out on economic issues, mm-hmm. and so they're just going to vote on cultural issues. Mm-hmm. The challenge then is to have one of the parties, and Mike, and I hope it's the Democratic Party, to start representing in a real way ordinary citizens' economic interests to get people to start voting for their economic interests.
I wish we had more time, because I think you touch a point, because this is a constant discussion around how people vote against their economic interests and the role of values that plays in our American experience.
And if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is we've just lost on the economic front, and so we busy ourselves with the issues which we seem to have the most influence over.
Well, yes, that's right. Or basically, because, you know, that voters aren't stupid.
A lot of people think they can change their economic status about what's going on, so now some people are now concerned about whether they're going to get to heaven.
Right.
And that's a very gross oversimplification, but I think it's part of what's going on.
Great. Thank you, caller.
And we'll
go to our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Before the Enlightenment and capitalism, the standard of living, or the poverty level for the common man in Europe, was at starvation. Capitalism has freed the common man. It wasn't socialists who brought about the 40-hour work week. It was capitalism. Capitalism is freedom. Those of you on the left need to understand that what you're doing, this is a con, that socialism will enslave people.
Okay, let the author respond. I don't think you mentioned the word socialism, have you, Mr. Sorrell?
No, I think that was what we just heard, was sort of a right-wing non-sequitur. Mm-hmm. you just sort of throw out, you know,
yeah.
socialist or whatever. I'm not really sure it was sort of incoherent. I think the idea that capitalism is responsible for the laws that make sure that we have, you know, workplace laws in this country that, for instance, create a 40-hour work week. I think that's not supported by the facts, that that the idea that an unbridled free market system with no regulations at all somehow created worker protections is ridiculous on the face of it. That what brought about workplace rights, what brought about food safety laws, what brought about
all sorts
of other regulations that protect mm-hmm. people, were citizens demanding that their government...
Those are all lies. You're a liar.
Okay. Thank you, caller. Goodbye.
See, that's what the right does. They just, socialist, liar, that they don't have any facts to back up anything they're saying, is that the government has played a role as a protector of ordinary citizens against the unbridled profit motive. That the unbridled profit motive, that the profit motive itself, capitalist profit motive, is something that's very necessary for society, mm-hmm. but that it goes awry if there's no referee.
Right.
If there's no government that's there to make sure that that profit motive doesn't run roughshod over the other needs of society.
One thing that your book does, it offers many examples in terms of how we are sold a bill of goods and how we just either hear things and repeat them. One issue you mentioned that just blew me away was your discussion on pensions and how...
Yes.
How unprotected ordinary citizens' pensions are, but the CEOs, they'll get theirs share.
Oh, they'll get theirs, and it's guaranteed.
Yeah, that's right. And we, you know, we hear a lot about the need for pension protection in this country. Meanwhile, we have a government that used to protect pensions, but that now quite literally has legalized pension ripoff schemes. So, for instance, tens of thousands of workers in this country are experiencing what's known as cash balance pension conversions.
Mm-hmm.
This is where a company will come to you after it's promised you for 30 years that it's going to give you a defined benefit pension, a certain stipend every month because you worked at the company for 35, 40 years. And they say, well, we're not going to give you that anymore. We're going to give you a lump sum payment.
Wow.
Turns out that lump sum payment is often 50 or 60% less than the benefit that you were supposed to get. The government has now said that that kind of conversion, that kind of reneging on the promise, is entirely legal. Bipartisan legislation was brought forward to make sure that companies would have to at least give workers a choice to stay in their old pension that they were promised. That was voted down. And now we see new pension legislation being brought forward that further erodes those kinds of protections and actually further allows companies to get out of paying into the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation, which is the government agency that protects pensions in the case that a company goes fully bankrupt. Right now there's about a $300 billion gap between what companies are promising workers and what they've set aside for workers' pensions. And again, as you alluded to, at the same time, companies have created special pensions for their executives that are protected and preserved even if the company goes completely belly up. And we see this all up and down the line, whether on pensions or on wages. On wages, for instance, we see Delphi, the subsidiary of GM, right now has gone before a bankruptcy court and asked the court to invalidate its previous labor contract so as to cut workers' wages. And in the same bankruptcy proposal, company executives are proposing a new $100 million in bonuses and additional compensation for executives. That's perfectly permissible under our bankruptcy and wage laws. So up and down the line, you see how there's a different set of rules for those pulling the levers of power than there are for those of us ordinary citizens who make up the vast majority of the country.
Now, the upshot of what I'm hearing you say with regard to the Democratic Party especially is that, yes, we are turning into possibly a two-and-a-half party system, but perhaps what we need to do is focus more on the Democratic Party and to take it back. Is that an accurate summation?
Well, I would agree with you. I would agree that any serious battle to take back our country's government is in part contingent on the battle to take back the Democratic Party. That we first and foremost need a real vehicle for small d democratic action, not Democratic Party action, but you know, pro-democracy action, and that the way to do that we've got to essentially fight back against the quarter or a third of the Democratic Party that has been complicit in the hostile takeover of our government. Once we then have a real, powerful, sustainable vehicle, I think then we can move forward in the bigger goal of taking back our whole country.
So with that in mind, then, what about those of us who have migrated to independent or third-party platforms? Is it then a call for them to come back and to help with the work of the Democratic Party and to abandon whatever infrastructures and networks they've put together for various progressive or independent or green, et cetera, venues?
I would say again, political advocacy, I think, needs to be based on more than just parties,
mm-hmm.
whether it's Green Party, Democratic Party, or Republican Party. It needs to be based on issues. It needs to be based on conviction and ideology that transcends party. The second thing I'll say is that third parties are not inherently good or bad. That a third party, arguably, in a situation that draws away voters from a good candidate in order to make a point, is bad when it comes to end results. But that there are third-party models that actually wield real power. And I know that in Oregon, they're considering, they might be considering allowing fusion voting.
Mm-hmm.
Fusion voting is where smaller parties have access to the ballot and can cross-endorse major party candidates. In New York, the Working Families Party is a fusion party. They strategically use their cross-endorsement of Democrats and some Republicans in order to advocate for a working people's agenda. And so, for instance, this party was credited with getting the Republican state Senate in New York to override the Republican governor's veto of minimum wage increase legislation. So that's a third-party model where the third party wields real power, where the third party doesn't force an either-or choice, and where the third party is able to use this model to accomplish serious progressive goals.
We've been speaking this morning with David Sirota, author of Hostile Takeover, How Big Government and Corruption Conquered Our Government and How We Take It Back. David will be speaking tomorrow at Powell's on Burnside at 7:30 p.m. Thank you, David, for joining us this morning, and we thank you for your good work and in inspiring us to continue the good fight.
Yes,
thank
we'd like to invite
you
back.
I really appreciate it.
Excellent. And coming up at 9 o'clock here on the Old Mo Variety Hour, you'll hear more news and commentaries on social events, issues, and trends. At 10 o'clock, Health Watch has Dr. David Naiman with guest Dr. William Kaiman, author of Easy Labor, Every Woman's Guide to Choosing Less Pain and More Joy During Childbirth. 10:30 brings Earth Watch with Dave Massa, interviewing environmental journalist Dave Helvarg about the state of the world's oceans. 11 o'clock brings Democracy Now! The guest is James Yee, a Muslim chaplain who was posted in Guantanamo Bay in 2002 and later accused of espionage and locked up in a Navy prison. And then tonight, tune in at 6, Labor Radio host Don McIntosh interviews the author of The Disposable American, Layoffs and Their Consequences. All this and more here on your Community Connection, KBOO, Portland.
We'll miss you next week.
Yes, but we will be back with Greg Palast. And it's the Armed Madhouse?
Yeah, I
All
think
right.
so.
Okay, so be sure to be here on your Community Connection, 90.7 FM in Portland, KBOO FM.
Good morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland. It's time now for the Radio Zine for Monday the 22nd. Coming right up, it's the Old Mole Variety Hour. At 10 o'clock, Health Watch comes up with Dr. David Naiman speaking with Dr. William Kamen, author of Easy Labor, Every Woman's Guide to Choosing Less Pain and More Joy During Childbirth. At 10:30 on Earthwatch, Dave Mazza interviews environmental journalist David Helvarg about the state of the world's oceans. And at 11 o'clock on Democracy Now!, the guest is James Lee, a Muslim chaplain who was posted in Guantanamo Bay in 2002 and later accused of espionage and locked up in a Navy prison. Also, tune in tonight at 6 o'clock on Labor Radio. Host Don McIntosh interviews the author of The Disposable American: Layoffs and Their Consequences.